came to their work hours and reducing those hours stuck in traffic trying to get to the office. The CEO, Marissa Mayer, said that will all come to an end in June. The staff was told recently that they will be required to be physically in the workplace, no more working from home. Needless to say, that announcement was greeted with some howls inside the company and across the country by those who see telecommuting as a way to take advantage of technology and to bring greater balance and control over work and home responsibilities. Others, on the other hand, hailed the decision, saying that FaceTime at work can lead to greater collaboration, greater creativity, and more productivity. It's our topic for today's Radio Times, and let me introduce our two guests. Raymond Fissman is the Lambert Family Professor of Social Enterprise, Director of the Social Enterprise Program at Columbia Business School. He's also co-author with Tim Sullivan of The Org, The Underlying Logic of the Office, and he joins us from the Columbia University Business School studio. And nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Nice to be with you.
Also with us is Jennifer Glass. She's the Barbara Bush Professor of Liberal Arts in the Department of Sociology, also Research Associate in the Population Research Center at the University of Texas in Austin. And Jennifer Glass, nice to have you with us on Radio Times as well.
Thanks for inviting me.
Jennifer, let me begin with you. And both you and Ray are college professors. How much work do you do at home and how much work do you do at the office? Jennifer?
I would say that I split my time about 60-40, and about 60% would be at home and about 40% would be at the office.
How about for you, Ray?
Let me put it this way. My 5-year-old daughter says I have my work office, my coffee shop office, and my home office.
And is she right?
She is absolutely right, and I probably spend most of my time at the coffee shop office.
Well, what do you make of Marissa Mayer, the CEO, of this decision that employees at Yahoo have to literally be at work? What's your response to that, Ray?
Well, I think one point that has been made about this is that all is not exactly well at Yahoo, and that Marissa Mayer is trying to shake things up, as rightly she should. That she's trying to shift a culture where no one comes in. Imagine that you're the one person who shows up to work to this empty parking lot on Friday. You're pretty quickly going to decide it's not worth your while. And while it is the case that college professors like me do a lot of tasks that are easily done from a distance much of the time, the management of Columbia Business School would quickly unravel if we never came to the office. And I also think it's worth pointing out that Marissa Mayer is not going to put a camera above every Yahoo employee's desk to monitor how they spend every second. But she is trying to encourage face-to-face collaboration at the company, which is hard to do from a distance.
Indeed it is. I want to pick up on some of the points you made, but let me get a response from you, Jennifer, about Marissa Mayer's decision. What's your response?
I've sometimes likened it to using a hammer to kill a fly. I think that there are many ways that you can continue to allow employees to telecommute without saying you never show up at the office. So many firms, for example, have core times during the day when people have to be on site, or they have core days. University faculty, of course, have meetings, right? So there are classes that you have to meet. There are faculty meetings where you have to be on campus. So there are times when everybody is there face-to-face, and I do agree that that's important. But that's not what happened at Yahoo. What happened was sort of a blanket ban. Mm-hmm. And I've heard some whisperings from colleagues in the Silicon Valley area that this is only temporary, but it's very difficult for an employee who has ongoing family responsibilities to bank on the fact that this is temporary.
But it seems to me, Jennifer, that this is a test for Yahoo and its CEO, the idea of bringing everyone to work. Will there actually be improvements, and will the company be in better shape? Do you see this as a test?
I think that it might be an excuse for creating a leaner and meaner Yahoo. In other words, I've heard rumors that this might be a mechanism through which there's some attrition from the firm, mm-hmm. and in particular attrition from employees who are starting startups on their own in their free time and things of that nature and not really dedicated to the company. I don't really know what's going on at Yahoo, and I would hate to second-guess their CEO, but we know from surveys of young workers in particular that they're very interested in flexibility, and they don't want to work someplace where they have to be at a desk 9 to 5, or even chatting in a cafeteria or playing pool in an employee lounge.
Ray, picking up on some of the things that Jennifer said, the idea, and I guess this discussion has been framed as an either or, either you're at work mm-hmm. or you're at home, but it sounds like there is some middle ground that gives employees some flexibility, but also provides for some face time, as you describe it. And also, I guess it allows for managers and bosses to see what people are doing.
Yeah, I would very emphatically draw the distinction between what's going on at Yahoo and general trends and what is generally good for a workplace. Because I'd emphasize again, like, she's trying to turn around what is, by consensus, a sort of broken work environment. I also would emphasize, and I do think this is important, that these are tasks that require creativity, some amount of freedom. It's hard to measure progress on a particular project. You're trying to come up with new ideas, be innovative. So again, the idea is not that employees will be watched over every second. I was actually just out in Silicon Valley last week. I do some work with eBay. And I arrived at the eBay campus a little early, so I took a little walk. They have some nice nature trails around there, and it was around lunchtime. And I saw dozens and dozens of eBay engineers going for walks on these nature trails. And, you know, that's not something that would fly in many workplaces, but they were genuinely doing work in their perambulations of the area around eBay.
But is that your argument or a argument for the value of FaceTime and whether people are hunched over a table working on a project or, it sounds lovely, walking through the bucolic woods of eBay?
Yeah, I'm sure most, we rarely have extreme answers to any question. Like, of course, there's some balance between the two. But, you know, I think Marissa Mayer was trying to make an emphatic statement because at her organization, the norms had shifted far too much towards people lazing about at home rather than, you know, working for the good of the company.
Well, and Jennifer, I'm assuming, you know, some people can be so productive at home and some, as Ray was just saying, can take advantage of the opportunity of not having a boss nearby monitoring what they do.
I think that there's a misconception that productivity is somehow enhanced by FaceTime. And most of the evaluations of telecommuting suggest that productivity is actually enhanced when people have the opportunity to avoid that nasty long commute, sequester themselves in an environment where they're not peppered with phone calls or questions, and side conversations about,
right,
you know, last night's football game or whatever, and actually focus and concentrate on getting the work done. So I think it really depends on the management strategy at the firm. Some firms have developed very good management strategies for developing metrics for weekly progress or other indicators that work is being done. And then they leave their employees alone and let them decide what mix of time at the office and time at home they need. So I don't know what the managerial culture was like at Yahoo, but it seems to me that it's fundamentally a managerial problem. And some tech companies in particular have figured out how to do this well, and other companies have not. The larger questions are questions about innovation. Do companies actually innovate more when all of their employees are on site? And I think that's an unknown. There's really no good research that I could find out there about this topic, but there's a lot of inference in the business press that direct face-to-face interaction is always the best. And I'm just not sure that that's the case.
Ray, you want to add to that or respond to that?
Yeah, I do think that there is some evidence from the world of academic collaborations that co-location, being at the same university, which is not the same thing as showing up to the office every day to chat in the coffee room, but being at the same university leads to greater citations of work by people nearby you, which suggests that, you know, some of this stuff is dictated by being in close physical proximity to others. And I do think this distinction is quite important because one of the most commonly cited studies in the wake of the Marissa Mayer statement is one of Chinese customer service agents who are doing a job that really can be monitored minute by minute, second by second. You know, how many phone calls are they answering? How many are they converting into sales? So that's really quite distinct from the sort of tasks that we have in mind when we talk about what Silicon Valley engineers are doing. I also think it's noteworthy in that study that despite the fact that productivity increased and people working from home reported that they were happier in their jobs, a very sizable minority chose to go back to the office after the experiment had run its course. That is, people also desire some amount of this face time. This goes back to you shouldn't think about the world as being one of extremes where you want to be just out of the office or just in the office. Some mix is surely healthy for most people.
But are you talking about people or some people being literally just lonely working at home by themselves, right?
Well, what I can tell you is that the experiment had people working from their bedrooms or kitchen tables, removed from the hangar-sized row upon row of cubicles, which was the alternative, and many chose to come back to the hangar rather than stay in their pajamas in their bedroom.
And that was in China?
Yep.
Going back to something you said, Jennifer, but about how you manage, I guess, or how managers manage people working long distance or working from home or working out of the office, does that raise questions about trust and whether managers, do they trust their employees if they can't see them?
Well, I think that there's kind of an old school and new school divide. I think that traditionally, which I would call the old school theory of management, you really had to sort of rein herd and provide direction on a daily basis to your employees. But in the tech sector, things are a little bit different. I mean, this is a creative class of workers. Mm-hmm. And, of course, tasks vary. Some require engineering teams where you definitely have to be together a lot in order to facilitate some new platform or whatever else. But when it comes to new ideas and developing new ideas, I always think about hackers who are among the most desirable employees in Silicon Valley. They are very rarely working in teams at the office. They're working in secret, probably in a coffee shop someplace.
Exactly.
In a remote connection. But in many ways, they are the most creative programmers. So, I think it's an open question. The one study that I know of that looked at citations in academia and scholars working together was done before Skype, before Dropbox, before many of the technological tools that we now have to facilitate direct face-to-face interaction without being in the same physical place. I'm part of a team that's now spanning two continents at present, and we have a weekly Skype meeting, and we have metrics for what we have to accomplish during the week, and I know that if I don't accomplish my piece, I'm going to have to face all of those people, literally face them all on a screen, usually from my living room at 9 o'clock in the morning, and explain to them why I didn't get something done that week or when it will be done or what I found or whatever else. So I think you can have the same kind of accountability and you can have the same kind of creative interchange of ideas via the use of technologies.
Well, we're going to take a very short break and then get back to our conversation talking about some of the pros and cons of telecommuting, talking with Jennifer Glass and Raymond Fissman, and we want to hear from you. What do you think? Give us a call, 1-888-477-9499. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, the Academy of Vocal Arts, presents Don Quixote, March 2nd through 9th, in AVA's Helen Corning Warden Theater, and March 12th and 14th at Centennial Hall in Haverford. Jules Massenet's opera is a lyrical ode to the chivalrous idealist Don Quixote. Christopher Makatsouris conducts the AVA Opera Orchestra, with staging by Tito Capobianco. 215-735-1685 or avaopera.org.
The budgetary discussions currently taking place in Washington present challenges for people in our community and for WHYY. Yet, at the same time, we have continued to expand our services. I'm Bill Morazzo. Your support to WHYY in the last 5 years has offset government losses, yet resulted in the growth of the services you rely on. A donation today will enable us to continue to fulfill our promise to you. Visit WHYY.org to make a donation.
Hey, Seeking This American Life, why do anything new? Let's face it, we love routine, we want things to stay the same. Reruns are more comforting than regular TV.
Last night, I was watching TV and I couldn't find a rerun anywhere, and I was like panicking and flipping. Oh, there was a rerun though. It was like a rerun of like The Nanny was on, and I don't have any relationship with it, so I was like stuck.
Live Stuck in Reruns this week.
Tonight at 9 on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowen. Do you telecommute? Do you want to? Do you think it's a good idea, a bad idea? Give us a call at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Let me reintroduce our guest. Jennifer Glass is the Barbara Bush Professor of Liberal Arts in the Department of Sociology and Research Associate in the Population Research Center. That's at the University of Texas in Austin. And Raymond Fissman is the Lambert Family Professor of Social Enterprise, Director of the Social Enterprise Program. That's at Columbia Business School, co-author of a book called The Org, The Underlying Logic of the Office. And again, we have calls coming in at 1-888-477-9499. Jennifer, you and some colleagues at some interesting research looking at telecommuting, basically saying that what has happened, I guess, is that with the opportunity of telecommuting, people go to work and then they work all night because they're still plugged into their office. Can you expand on that?
Right. What we're really talking about is how America's workforce really telecommutes. And what we find is that most employers still require their employees to be on site for roughly 35 to 40 hours per week. And most of the telecommuting that's going on is really additional overtime work that people do in the evenings and weekends when they're sick, when they're on vacation. So that telecommuting usually increases workers' work days and work week.
Do you think that's by design or by accident?
I think it's by accident. I think that most companies are still uncomfortable with telecommuting during the regular workday, and so they still use the metric of face time at the office to determine who's productive and who's committed to the firm. So as a consequence, the technology that we have, our smartphones and our computers, all of those things that enable us to work from home, are being used to squeeze more work out of employees. And so they take work home in the evenings. It's now become sort of ubiquitous for managers and professionals to have to work 50 or 60 hours per week instead of 40. And so they do some of that work at home.
Is that a problem, Ray, from your perspective? Or does that raise problems?
Well, in general, work hours have been trending upward over time. I don't know how much technology has contributed to it. I'm frankly unfamiliar with the study that was just referenced. But it would be troubling if that described my own life. And I think it's very hard to shut oneself off.
And this is the three offices that your daughter said you had?
So, but the three offices that my daughter says I have are largely constrained to the hours of 8 to 5 each day.
Right.
But sort of I'm in the blessed position of having an immense amount of both autonomy and job security.
You're a lucky person. But it seems to me that most people, and probably most people listening to us, Ray, are not professors, don't have the perfect kind of job as you appear to have. But largely are expected to be at work at a certain amount of time and are on site, 8-9 hours a day. Would you say that describes most of the workforce?
I do think it describes most of the workforce. I'm going to go back to the previous observation that, there's no way that the right mix is either an extreme of just being in the office or just being at home. So could there be more flexibility in the workforce? It surely is the case. Is working from home better suited to some tasks than others? That's also surely the case.
But Jennifer, it sounds like you're also talking about a generational difference and using tech employees, which of course covers a lot of skills these days, that sort of culture and ethos might be changing the workplace bottom up?
Well, I think that the younger generation clearly values flexibility a lot, and they're much more likely to make job decisions based on those criteria than older workers. And that's not my own research. That comes from some of the work that Ellen Galinsky has done at the Families and Work Institute. But I think that the important takeaway is that right now businesses are not particularly receptive to that. And as long as we have kind of a buyer's market in terms of low labor demand and high unemployment, then I don't think we have the push to change this. Mm-hmm. There are lots and lots of jobs that could be more flexible. Clearly, if you can work overtime at home using your technology, you could probably do some of that work during your regular first 40 hours of work each week. But it's not happening. And I think it's not happening because we don't have a managerial culture in general that supports this. The tech sector was unusual because it did rely so much on these creative types who could move to another firm whose labor was indeed very highly valued.
But there is this issue of control and whether the employee has control over their work and their hours or whether their employer does. Could you speak to that first, Jennifer, and then to you, Ray, and then we'll get to our callers?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I think that there are lots and lots of qualitative accounts. I love this book that's called Competing Devotions. It was a qualitative study of finance industry executives, and they would talk about how they felt their mission was to not only be at the office all the time, but to role model this for their other employees, to demand this kind of self-sacrifice of home and family and community because they were so devoted to the work, and that that display of devotion was what should earn you promotions and greater authority in the workplace.
Ray, is that still true?
Well, it's certainly still true on Wall Street from what my students tell me. I do think that, you know, in talking about what can and can't be accomplished in shifting work from the workplace, the office, to the home, you know, there are these demonstration effects that are appearing now. I'll go back to the China study, for example, where we now know, you know, prior to that, there wasn't a clear demonstration of the value of giving customer service representatives this option. Now we know it's true. I presume that some companies will respond to that by giving greater flexibility to some of their workers in this regard.
But it's interesting. I mean, do you think workers should have that choice, or is that really their manager's or their employee's decision about where they work, right?
Well, it is a, like, it's bosses are called bosses for a reason. They get to boss people around. So, you know, that is their decision,
right,
in a company. It may be good for the company, may be bad for the company, but that is their, they are given that decision right. This is a case where it's going to depend on the task and it's going to depend on the employee. So this is a case where C-Trip, the Chinese company in question, found it really worked.
So bosses still have the right to boss, Jennifer?
Oh, absolutely. And I think that's why we see such a slow diffusion of schedule flexibility and telecommuting in the American labor force. I think the British case, now this is not about telecommuting, but it's about flexible work hours, start and end times of the day. And the British experiment was called the right to ask. So the British government allowed employees the right to ask for accommodations, especially if they had small children at home. And employers then had the burden of proving, if they said no, that it would truly be a disruption. And it's now been about 6-7 years since that law was passed, and about 95% of employers in Great Britain now say, oh, it's really not a big deal. Uh-huh. I think the fear is the fear of innovation. I don't want to be the only company that tries this and then finds out it doesn't work. That will put me in a bad competitive position vis-a-vis my other competing firms. So I think that sometimes that's why we need federal regulation, to just sort of say, hey, this is a huge problem in our nation. We have all of these parents who are working, and we have these other people, single or not, parents or not, who have elderly parents, or they have other relatives that they're caring for, and they need this kind of flexibility. We're not giving it to them, and it's costing us.
And that's Jennifer Glass, who joins us along with Raymond Fissman. And we are talking about telecommuting. We are talking about employee-employer relations when it comes to issues of flexibility on the job and issues of control as well. And we've got, surprise, surprise, a full bank of calls here at 1-888-477-9499. We love to talk about work on Radio Times. Let's see what Mary from Perkiomenville has to say. And Mary, go ahead. You're on the air.
Oh, hi.
Hi.
Thanks
there
for taking my call.
You're welcome.
I'm a sole proprietor. I do website services, and I've worked at home alone for 11 years. And I really find that I have a big network of friends who do similar type of work. And when dealing with them and dealing with clients, I really find that people are either super productive and like workaholics, Or they're the opposite extreme where they have a hard time focusing and they can fritter their day away on different things like, you know, TV and laundry and stuff like that. And it really depends on how tech-savvy they are, their personality, and how prone they are to get lonely. Like, I think for some people it works beautifully and it's a big advantage to the company, and for some people it's a mess. So as somebody who is a huge advocate of telecommuting, I really have to come to Marissa Meyer's defense here, because I can see how it's an issue at a large organization where I'm sure that they have a big mix of personalities.
Well, Mary, I appreciate the call to Radio Times. Let me give Ray a chance to respond to her comment. Agree?
Well, I do think she's brought up, you know, the fact that there are these two elements. One is what makes me productive, and the other is what makes me happy. And there's some alignment between the two, but it's not perfect. I'll go back to the fact that you had some people, some customer service agents, who were more productive at home but still chose to come back to the office. Made them lonely and unhappy.
Jennifer, you want to add to that or respond to that?
Yeah, I think that it's obviously the case that some people are going to be less productive workers when they're at home. They're going to find it distracting, and they need more structure. And that's why good management is so important, that you do have metrics and you can identify those people that need to be brought back in. Mm-hmm. But I don't think you need to do that for your entire workforce because you have a problem with a few. I also think that we talk about slacking at home a lot, and we forget that people slack at the office as well. So there are just as many people who might be more productive at home but are constrained by the office environment and find it very distracting to have coworkers around and end up chit-chatting by the water cooler all day long instead of getting work done as well.
Hi, Mary, thanks for the call. Let's see what Lee from Philadelphia has to say. And Lee, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi, thank you. I'm a director for a consulting company that works with small independent florists, and we have over 15 employees. We all work from home offices throughout the country. And I find that my staff is just, you know, incredibly productive, with rare exception. And those that are the exceptions tend to weed themselves out early in their employment with us. Our staff has a very strong work ethic. They're highly communicative, often overly so, some having to be tamed somewhat, because they want their managers to know that they are working and that they're productive. And the technologies today to be able to monitor, we don't really go overboard in monitoring our staff. We have weekly meetings and weekly goals that we all need to achieve. Of course, I can look at my phone directory right now and see that my two salespeople are fast at work, smiling and dialing right now. But, you know, we don't overly monitor them. We find that trying to encourage our staff to have a balance of, you know, work and a real life is the hardest thing for us to get across.
Well,
I often know most people are commuting in the morning. I'm doing my emails. It's difficult to find the balance.
Well, that's interesting. And Lee, I mean, would you say that you hired well in that you hired people who largely are very productive for you?
Yeah, I think we have hired well, and I think they are productive at home. And certainly there's advantages to working from home. It's wonderful on my 15-minute break. I blocked out 30 minutes on my Google Calendar. I'll be done with you guys in a few minutes, and maybe I'll throw a load of laundry in, but I'll be back at work out of my break, and everybody knows I'm on my break from the Google Calendar, and it's nice to have that little luxury. But I do think it's something that the vast majority of our staff do not take for granted and relish the opportunity to have that flexibility in their work life.
Well, I appreciate the call to Radio Times. I'll get back to work, Lee, and thanks for the call. Jennifer, anything you want to add to what Lee just said?
Yes, one of the things that we forget is that because telecommuting arrangements are still relatively rare, when you offer them to your employees, they're tremendously grateful. It's amazing to me the kind of loyalty that is bred when you show some consideration for the work-life constraints that your employees are facing.
And we're talking about less than 20% of the population. Is that right, Jennifer?
Right.
To you, Ray, I'd be curious what you say in response to what Lee described as his workforce.
Well, what it reminded me of, first of all, it sounds like it's an arrangement where both the culture as well as the tasks involved are well suited to people working largely independently around the country. What it did remind me of is my friend Drew Curtis, who runs a largely virtual company called FARC. It's a website. And most of the people, in fact, everyone who works for FARC works from home or works remotely. But I remember something Drew said to me not too long ago when we were talking about exactly these sorts of issues, that despite the fact that mostly they each do their own thing, they absolutely have to get together in person with some frequency, because otherwise misunderstanding upon misunderstanding, the layers of misunderstandings build up through the low fidelity communication that's afforded through email and so on. He described the sort of paranoia that develops unless they get together in the same room and have it out in person. So I think that even the most virtual of organizations find it useful now and again to actually have FaceTime.
Even beyond Skype FaceTime, right?
Yeah, I certainly use Skype. I use Skype by and large to sustain relationships rather than begin new ones. But I don't. It's hard for me to imagine having a deep and probing conversation with five people via a conference Skype line, or to brainstorm on new things rather than sustaining existing ones. I'm sure a lot of this is individualized. I've heard people express both sentiments, that Skype has replaced face-to-face interaction with them. I've also heard lots of people express the sentiment that I just did.
Well, Jennifer, this is not all human beings, because some are more social than others, but we are social creatures to some degree.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And I would say that I would hesitate to discourage all face-to-face interaction, because I think there is a limitation to simply interacting virtually with teams. But I think that we don't want to exaggerate the amount of that face-to-face interaction that's productive and innovative, and the amount that's just producing friendly solidarity between people. We all need that. But you can also get that at your coffee shop. I have many colleagues who also work at coffee shops, and they become regulars, and that becomes sort of a second-tier family for those people, a comfortable place to work. So our needs for sociability can be met in a lot of different ways. I also think that teams don't necessarily need to meet on-site at a single workplace. So some of the most creative things that companies are doing are investing in these off-site centers to, again, avoid the daily commute. They're decentralized in more residential areas. But you can go there, you can plug in, you'll meet other tech people, for example, maybe people who work at other companies, maybe people who work in marketing or design or something else. And so you have this creative mix of people, not just from your firm, but from other firms as well. So I'm always reminded that sometimes the best ideas come when you meet your future clients or your future customers, or you talk to older people, or you talk to teenagers, and you find out what's most interesting to them, or what they would most like from their devices, for example.
Well, let's take another short break, and then we'll get back to our conversation. Lee, thanks for the call to Radio Times. You can call as well. And again, that phone number is 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. We are talking about some of the pros and cons of telecommuting, when it works and when it doesn't, and how workplaces are changing to accommodate it in some instances. And our guests are Jennifer Glass. She's the Barbara Bush Professor of Liberal Arts in the Department of Sociology at the University of Texas in Austin, where she's also a research associate in the Population Research Center. Also with us is Raymond Fissman. He's the Lambert Family Professor of Social Enterprise, director of the Social Enterprise Program at Columbia Business School, and co-author of a book called The Org, The Underlying Logic of the Office. Much more after this very short break. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Medford Lees, a Quaker-related community for those age 55-plus, supports WHYY. On March 23rd at 10:30 a.m., Medford Lees presents A Land Twice Promised, a performance by Noah Baum. Baum creates a moving testimony, illuminating the complex history and emotions that surround Jerusalem for Israelis and Palestinians alike. Light lunch and discussion follow the lecture, co-sponsored by Medford Friends Meeting. More information about Medford Lees communities and to RSVP online at medfordlees.org.
On the next Fresh Air, Mohsen Hamid talks about his new novel, How to Get Filthy Rich in Rising Asia. The answer for his main character is by passing off boiled tap water as expensive bottled mineral water in a city which closely resembles Lahore, Pakistan, where Mohsen Hamid lives. His previous novel, The Reluctant Fundamentalist, has been made into a movie. Join us.
This afternoon at 3 and again tonight at 7 on WHYY. I'm Robin Young. Join us next time for the news and these stories here and now. Critics of gun laws say they don't work, but a new study from Children's Hospital Boston says states with the most gun laws have lower rates of deaths from guns. Also, Grammy Award-winning violist Kim Kashkashian. That's Public Radio's Daily Digest of News and Culture here and now.
Today at noon on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen talking with Jennifer Glass and Raymond Fissman and with you. Let me see what Jana from Furlong, Pennsylvania has to say. And Jana, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi.
Hi,
yes,
there.
It's Jana.
Jana.
I'm a project manager for a large pharmaceutical company, and most of my department telecommutes 3 or even 4 days a week out of necessity, because the two offices we have are about 3 hours apart from each other. So rarely does one live next to both of them. Mm-hmm. But every Thursday, everyone does meet in the office. And I wanted to address the issue of trust and loyalty that Jennifer was speaking of, because when I was hired and I was told about this arrangement, to automatically be given such a long leash and someone invest that amount of trust in you, believe me, you don't want to betray it. And I have found over the past 4 years I've been here that I've worked harder than any other job I've had before as a result, because I want to make sure I prove myself in that way. However, having said that, a basic tenet of success I believe is just showing up. And so it is important on those days when everyone is expected into the office to be there.
Well, Jenna, I appreciate the call to Radio Times. And Jennifer, since she referenced you, let me give you a chance to respond.
Well, I think that's absolutely true on both counts. I think it is important that when you are required in the office or you're needed for travel or whatever else, that you do show up. But I do find in my own work, I did a study with employed pregnant women who then had the decision to make about whether or not to go back to work. And those that had employers that were supportive and would allow them to telecommute or would allow them to set their own schedule were vastly more likely to return. Mm-hmm. And once they returned, they were incredibly dedicated employees. They were not going to leave that firm. They were going to show them that this investment was worthwhile.
Ray, you want to respond to that? Does that make sense to you?
Yeah, I mean, it reminds me of something that one of the authors of the China study, a Stanford professor named Nick Bloom, said, who's also looked at telecommuters at companies like JetBlue, is that they are able to hire these vastly overqualified people who really enormously value the flexibility. It's essentially echoing something that Jennifer said earlier. Mm-hmm. They enormously value this flexibility that's given to them. And they are very often, in the interactions that he had, working moms who want this ability both to work fewer than 40 hours a week, but also to pick their hours.
Ray, is it harder for managers, CEOs, bosses to promote people if they're not at work?
So I think that it is broadly true. So I'm just going to talk about empirically what time use studies seem to have to say about this. People in the upper echelons of companies do spend, whether this is right or not, they do spend an enormous amount of their time in face-to-face meetings. And the rationale that's generally provided for that is that there are certain sorts of information that can't be conveyed via a spreadsheet, via a report that's sent through email. So that has, in fact, been one of the constants across the decades, that corporate executives spend 80% of their time in face-to-face meetings today, just as they did back in 1970, despite, these are studies, these time use studies on CEOs post-date innovations like Skype, smartphones, et cetera.
Should we revisit that, Jennifer? How advance in your career if you're working from home? Do you see that as an issue?
Well, I think it is an issue, because I do think that the metric that too many companies use is still face time at the office. But having said that, we did this evaluation where we looked long-term at a large cohort of workers from 1989 until 2008 to see what happened during the years that they telecommuted and the years that they didn't. And we found that those who telecommuted during the first 40 hours of work, so this is the kind of flexible telecommuting that a lot of workers want, we didn't see any change in their pattern of wage growth over time. Hmm. So we don't know if they got promoted or not, but we were looking at least their earnings increases with the same employer. And we didn't see them suffering at all for that. And that was good news. What we did see, on the other hand, was that the workers who are doing this, what we called overtime telecommuting, just bringing work home and engaging in work for the employer while you're on vacation or weekends and things like that, we found that that didn't benefit them, that they didn't get any additional earnings the following year or over the next mm-hmm. 2 or 3 years. So it kind of led us to think, why are we putting in all of these extra hours?
Such an excellent question. but you think, is that because the employer doesn't know that their employee is putting in all these extra hours over the weekend and on sick days and vacations?
We don't know for sure, but I certainly suspect that's part of it.
Well, let me get back to our callers. We have Amy from Phoenixville, Pennsylvania, joining us on Radio Times. Amy, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi.
Hi there.
I just started a job in July, and it's completely work from home. I had never done that before, and it's worked out wonderfully. I have two small kids. It's very convenient. Doesn't impact on my personal time. The one problem I've had, the one thing I miss about working in an office is I'm having a really hard time learning this job. I think that if I was in an office where I was surrounded by people doing my same job, that I would learn faster and I would know, I would hear who kind of knows what they're doing and people who maybe don't know so much, and I would very quickly go to the people that know and ask my questions. Now, being isolated, I just have to pick and choose at random and hope that the person that I'm instant messaging or emailing really does know what they're doing. And it has caused some trouble.
Well, that's a very interesting comment, Amy. Let me see what Ray Fisman has to say and then Jennifer Glass. Have you run into that, Ray?
I mean, what makes me think of is the comment that, it's very difficult to start a new project remotely. In that, there's a lot of presumably there's some amount of ambiguity in exactly what the job is, and there's some stuff that you can learn better interacting in close proximity to others. It may be hard to pick up the culture of an organization sitting connected via broadband connection rather than being physically seeing what other people are doing.
Right.
It goes back to the need to have both things, both FaceTime as well as the flexibility to, as the caller suggested, work efficiently and manage one's personal life from home.
Anything you want to add, Jennifer, to what Amy said?
I agree with Ray. I think it's kind of sad that she was thrust at home right away without being adequately trained and not having a point person that she can go to when she has questions who, if that person doesn't know the answer, will go and find it for her instead of having to, kind of go through the Rolodex and see who you can find to answer the questions that you have.
But that raises then questions about, so if you're going to have employees who work at home, then you have to figure out how to help them and manage them in their workload, Jennifer.
Right, absolutely. And again, I agree with Ray that it sounds like there was no kind of training period on site to meet the managers, understand the climate of the company, figure out who knows what, so that when you have issues that come on down the line, you know who to contact.
Amy, thanks for the call to Radio Times. Let's see what Anthony from North Wales has to say. And Anthony, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi, Marty.
Hi.
Thanks
there.
For taking my call.
You're very welcome. Go ahead.
Yes, I just wanted to point out two other benefits that we're seeing. I work in a transportation planning group in North Wales, and one benefit that we see to telecommuting is that it can cut down on the traffic in an area. For instance, I work next to the big Merck West Point facility, and if they got just 5% of their employees to telecommute, it would make a big difference on the traffic on local roadways. The same would be for Vanguard and Malvern, too. So that's one benefit. Another one that we tell employers when they're thinking about telecommuting is to think about how much they can tap into diversity. A lot of times people with mobility issues, they might be on oxygen or be in wheelchairs, and they might not be able to get to the workplace. But if they're offered the option to telecommute, then the employer can still benefit from all that experience.
Anthony, you raise us a number of good points. I appreciate the call to Radio Times. And, Ray, we haven't really talked about traffic and hours, you know, stuck in traffic commuting. But that's a real issue, and in some parts of the country, a huge issue.
Yeah, so I certainly don't know much about the urban planning implications of this, but I would go back to an earlier comment by Jennifer and the policies of the UK government that, you know, when I say that it's the boss's purview to boss people around, that is it, within the bounds that society has placed around him, in that, you know, there are legal constraints, there are employment laws, as there well should be. So if we decide that there is a social good that's created by promoting and giving incentives or requiring the right to telecommute for these reasons that have these spillovers to the lives of others through its effects on traffic patterns or something else, you know, that's a larger societal decision.
Well, Jennifer, there every now and then there'll be a study about certain parts of the country. I think Atlanta was one I saw recently, and computing the numbers of hours that people are literally sitting in traffic. And it's pretty eye-opening. How do you think about that stuff?
Well, I live in Austin, Texas, which is a rapidly growing city, and believe me, we have plenty of sitting in traffic time here as well. It's interesting that you asked that, and I love the fact that the caller mentioned this, because when I first started working on telecommuting, almost all of the articles were by geographers and traffic planners, and they were talking about the amount of greenhouse gas emissions that we could cut, and the amount of travel time, the amount of road rage we could reduce. So there are a lot of externalities that would benefit by having more of the labor force telecommute, or even just some schedule flexibility so everyone doesn't have to be at the office between 8 and 9 o'clock in the morning.
Anthony, thanks for the call to Radio Times. What about this issue, Jennifer, he raised about mobility, the idea that you could actually expand your workforce to be much more diverse because you might be hiring people who literally couldn't get to work?
I think that's fantastic, and I honestly do think that in some ways having very small children that you're responsible for is like a disability. I mean, you have to care for them 24/7, or you have to find somebody else to do it 24/7. And we also can't forget that people oftentimes live in areas that are underserved by public transportation, and our inner cities are a good example of that. So you make it possible for people to work who might not otherwise be able to make it to some corporate campus way out in the far suburbs.
Ray, anything you want to say in response to that?
Well, I would go back to the larger social problem, which is that if we actually want this sort of equality of access, which I think is something that is desirable, this is something where there is a role for government directive.
Let me see what, is it Larry? Let me see what Larry from Wilmington has to say. Larry, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
I've spent a good bit of time in IT consulting as a technical lead, and worked at a client a couple of years ago where all the employees had to work in the office, but all the contractors had to telecommute. Hmm. And I think you touched on it in one of your comments earlier. We had real complex issues come up, and you couldn't get the full-time people to answer phones or the instant messaging. And we finally had to convince the client to let us come in a day or two a week just so we could have the collaborative meetings to answer all the technical or complicated stuff. And so it does happen, even in IT, that sometimes you need to be together.
That you actually need to be together. Well, I appreciate the call, Larry, to Radio Times. And it sounds like that's something you believe as well.
Yeah, as I mentioned previously, I was out at eBay days after Marissa Mayer made her pronouncement. And certainly the chatter at eBay was that they sort of understood why she did it. I should say that lots of people at eBay spend plenty of time working outside the office, but there is generally this culture of people coming in.
Let me get one more caller in. Looks like we have Maggie from Westchester joining us on Radio Times. And Maggie, go ahead. You are on the air.
Hi, Marty. How are you? As
good.
I'm handing my daughter a cup of cereal. I am a full-time mom, and I also own my own business. I taught for 6 years in a public school before I resigned from my job when I had my baby. And while I'm not telecommuting for an employer, I have professional responsibilities to myself and to authors that I work with, but
right.
Also to my daughter. And it's been very, very difficult to strike a balance between taking care of her full time and taking care of my professional responsibilities full-time. And I was just wondering if your guests have any input on how they've been able to strike a balance working from home, not getting distracted, and how do they get everything done that they need to get done.
Maggie, I appreciate the call to Radio Times. Jennifer, can I toss that to you?
Sure. I'm not an expert on this by any means, but I do know that many, many people who run home-based businesses say that one of the first things that you have to do is get child care assistance so that you can work, even if you're working from home, you can work knowing that somebody else is there to handle the spilled sippy cup or the child that's crying and, you know, needs immediate attention so that you're not constantly distracted. So I don't know if that's possible or if that's something that you would want to do, but a lot of entrepreneurs will say the same thing, that you still have to have some dedicated distraction-free time.
Ray, final word, anything you want to say in response to Maggie's call?
I would just second the answer that's already been given.
Well, on that note, my thanks to the both of you for joining us today in Radio Times. Ray Fissman, thank you very much.
Thanks for having me.
He's a Lambert Family Professor of Social Enterprise, Director of the Social Enterprise Program at Columbia Business School, co-author of a book called The Org. And Jennifer Glass, thank you very much as well.
Thanks for having me on the show.
You're welcome. She's the Barbara Bush Professor of Liberal Arts at the University of Texas at Austin and also Research Associate in the Population Research Center at the university. Well, today is Radio Times producer Dennis Devine's last day. He has been a member of the team for 3.5 years, and during that time has taken the show and all of us into the world of social media. It's been an eye-opening and exciting trip. He produced many memorable interviews, including the award-winning Zombies and Foreign Policy. He has been our go-to guy when we have had questions about grammar and spelling and punctuation and obscure facts. Dennis has taken a job at Drexel University, which sounds like a great fit for all his talents and interests. So Dennis, thanks for everything and best wishes on your new adventure from all of us at Radio Times and WHYY. We do rebroadcast Radio Times. You can tune in tonight from 10 until midnight. Coming up next, it's Here and Now. Tomorrow in the first hour of Radio Times.